Now we're going to talk books. Leah McFall is in with us with Books My Friends Borrowed and Never Gave Back. Kia ora, good morning.
Kia ora, lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you too. So, Books Your Friends Borrowed and Never Gave Back. We have had quite a few people get in touch with us on this subject. One person who takes photographs of the borrower with the book so that there's a record. Another person has emailed me, and we were just looking at this email, Leah. It's kind of like a raffle. You know, like raffle tickets where you get one and you tear a bit off. This one, that tears off a bookmark. They've had this book specially made. And then they keep the stub of who the person was and when they lent the book and what the title of the book was.
I mean, there's a degree of ingenuity in that.
There is.
And forward planning.
Yes.
That I clearly don't have. Because the books I brought along to talk to you about today, I've been waiting between a year and 12 years for. And the thing is about book borrowing and how casual we are about returning books. It seems so unusual that it's the sort of other people's stuff that we're really quite casual with. Mm. Like if I borrowed your leaf blower, I'd give it back to you, I'd say, the same day. Or if I borrowed a muffin tin from you, I'd use it, I'd wash it, I'd return it maybe in a week. But if I borrow a book, you might not get it back for 3, 6, 8 months, a year. Ever. And after a while, you sort of feel it's almost churlish to ask for the book back, if you know what I mean. So, and yet, we're so much more likely to be emotionally attached to the books we give away and lend out in a way that I don't know anybody who's emotionally involved with their leaf blower.
I don't know, muffin tins. Bakeware is pretty. Anyway, I know what you mean about the leaf blower, though.
But there's a lot of it about. Pretty much everybody I know is waiting on a book that never came home. Yeah. A friend of mine, Sam, he gave someone one of his Enid Blytons. It was a Secret Seven, if you must know.
I must know.
And he's been waiting 44 years for that book to come home. So
I don't want to break it to him, but
but you've got to give books, I think, in a spirit of generosity. You know, you can't begrudge a book, especially if somebody asks to borrow it. But in the case of these three titles, I'm not holding a grudge, because in these examples, I actually pressed this book onto my friends. They didn't ask to borrow them. I love these books so much for different reasons that I gave it to them insistently. Mm-hmm. And I also think with a book that's very good, potentially life-changing, one of these was life-changing for me, they deserve to be in circulation. You know, they shouldn't be on my bookshelf. They should be out there.
That's kind of how I always feel about it, that if the book comes back, that's great. If the book doesn't come back, I mean, I wouldn't let, there are certain like super precious, not even so much the book, but the actual copy of it that I wouldn't give away because it might not come back. But if it's a book that goes away and doesn't come back, then, you know, it's out there in the world for other people to enjoy.
I agree with you. And there's something very warm and very nourishing about that. It's like the people who won't give you a book, okay, fine if it's a first edition or something, but a person who refuses you a book when you ask, they're sort of like a person who refuses you a recipe. Do you know what I mean? I've been refused recipes in the past, and because they feel they're giving away something of themselves they don't want to give to you. And it's sort of like, I get it, and we're still friends. Mm. But part of you knows that person is happy if you go hungry.
Also, you're not really friends.
Not really. Not really. So it's a really good example of, like, if a friend gives you a really cherished book, then that's a good friend.
Okay. Right. Tell me about the books. Let's start with The Outrun.
Do you know, if you haven't read this, I envy you. I feel anyone who hasn't read this is lucky.
I have not read this.
Oh, it's so good.
Why am I lucky?
The Outrun, it came out in 2016. It was written by Amy Liptrot, who's a young woman. I don't think she's 40, from the Orkney Islands. So she's Orcadian. And this book quietly scooped up a number of significant awards and then sort of quietly went away. But it's about to return, I think, to people's attention because it's becoming a movie. It's just premiered at Sundance with Saoirse Ronan playing Amy Liptrot. Mm-hmm. So I do think, even though it is quite difficult to find this book in shops at the moment because it's a bit old now, I think they'll be ordering them in. So essentially, it's the story of Amy Liptrot's descent into alcoholism as a young woman in London in the early aughts, and her recovery or her road to recovery. But it's not a sort of predictable, if you like, memoir of addiction. Somewhere in the middle, it It takes flight into a new direction and becomes this formidable piece of modern British nature writing. And it's a book that opened a door for me as a reader into this rich world of nature writing, which is this incredible genre spanning every kind of, you know, natural setting you can imagine. So it opens with this prologue. It's the most beautiful scene, Susie. Mm. It's, if you can imagine, so the Orkney Islands, I know you know where they are.
I do, but I have never been.
Right, nor me.
Okay.
So there are a collection of about 70 islands north of mainland Scotland, and you kind of imagine they're right on the edge of things. You know, they're wind-blasted, rock formations, high cliffs. It's where the Atlantic and the North Sea, I think, meet, boiling and churning and cold and no trees and little cottages and everybody clinging on in the wind. And in the first scene, a helicopter is waiting with the rotors chopping, and two wheelchairs are being pushed towards it. In one wheelchair is a young woman with her newborn three-week-old baby, and in another wheelchair is a sedated man in a straitjacket. And the wheelchairs meet, and the woman hands over this tiny baby girl and introduces the man to his daughter before he is put into the helicopter and flown to Aberdeen for psychiatric treatment. And the baby is Amy Liptrot. So she has been born in Orkney. Drama has been part of her life since infancy. So she's in her 20s. She's not coping in London. And she writes really brilliantly about the kind of griminess of London and the pubs and the nasty flats, and her descent into alcoholism, her self-destructive behaviour, the loss of her relationship. She loses her job. She endangers herself with her behaviour. So she goes home to Orkney, she's newly sober. Mm-hmm. She goes home to Orkney to escape, I suppose, temptation. She doesn't intend to stay there. She's got an ambivalent relationship with her home. But the islands basically keep her there. And what happens is sort of everything and nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, she builds dry stone walls and she tracks bird life and she walks the island, she swims in cold water, she monitors the weather, she watches ships, she learns about the stars. Really monumental things happen in the islands. She ends up moving to smaller and smaller and smaller islands. She lives on this tiny island called Pape, where she looks out of one side of her cottage and she can see one coast, and the other side of her cottage she can see the other coast. And in heavy weather, the sea spray comes right across the island because it's only a kilometre across. In heavy weather, she wakes up the next day and there's a seal pup in someone's garden. Like, it's really on the edge of life in Orkney. But somehow she is soothed and healed and calmed by her surroundings. And I never thought you could write an interesting chapter about primroses or seabirds. But it does this remarkable thing where it slows you down as a reader, just as it has slowed her addiction down, and forces you into this sort of radical act of noticing your natural surroundings. It's like you can taste the salt. It is such a great book. I highly recommend it. But one thing I would say is that if you borrow it from the library, get the large print, because the font size is really small if you have specs. So that's what I would say. Get it from the library or order it from your independent bookshop. You can still get it.
Yep, fantastic. So that's The Outrun by Amy Liptrot. The next one, Garlic and Sapphires. This is a great title.
Yeah, so this is a kind of classic of food writing. Again, before I read it in 2005, which is when it came out, I had no idea that food writing was a thing, really. It's out of print now. It's going to be difficult for you to find it unless you borrow it from the library, as I did. So Ruth Reichel, this is her memoir of her time in the 90s as the New York Times restaurant critic. And it's so it's a memoir and a personal quest, along with the most extraordinary writing about food, the most sensual, very sexy writing about her various meals that she ate across New York. But it's a little bit more than that as well. At the beginning of the book, I'm quite conscious of the time, beginning of the book, she is actually the LA restaurant critic, and the New York Times want to coax her to work for them. And she goes there, and, you know, she's got a big personality and lots of tumbling black hair, and she's got, you know, big ideas, and she's been living the Californian life. Why would she want to come to this dusty, musty New York Times where everybody looks like a mole, no one goes outdoors, you know, they all take themselves far too seriously. She's like, why would I want to work here? But she takes the job. Partly because she's a native New Yorker coming home, but also because it's the most powerful job in foodie New York. Everyone is afraid of you as the New York Times critic. Your photo is up in every serious kitchen. Every maitre d' is waiting for you to come through the door. And when you arrive, you are treated like royalty. And so fairly early on, Ruth Reichel realizes she won't be able to do her listeners a service because she's being treated so well everywhere she goes. So she decides to go out to eat in disguise. So she finds herself a wig maker. She gets herself costumes. She gets an acting coach. She changes her personality, her tone of voice, her body language. And she goes and eats out incognito because she has to eat several times, you know, three or four, five times at each restaurant before she can write the review. Yeah. Back in the day when you had months to file a story and you had a credit card, you know. And she scandalizes New York with her first review when she very, very scandalously takes a star away from a very highly regarded French restaurant for treating her like dirt when she arrives dressed as an old lady, like sticking her by the toilets, throwing menus at her, making her wait at the bar, you know, treating her like, you know, dirt. And then when she goes back as herself, she is treated regally. The head of the restaurant comes across to her and says, the King of Spain is waiting at the bar, but your table is ready. And she gets, you know, the biggest raspberries and truffles and foie gras and lobster. And so she writes essentially two reviews saying to New York, this restaurant is not going to treat you very well if you're a nobody.
Yeah.
It is such a gripping read. It's a little bit camp. It's also a portrait, I think, of a New York that has gone now. One of the restaurants literally has gone. It was at the top of the World Trade Center. So it is a 20-year-old piece of social history. Very good.
Fantastic. Now, your last one that you have for us is 1234 by Craig Brown.
This is a recent book. This only came out in 2021. And Craig Brown is possibly Britain's foremost parody writer. He's been with Private Eye for 30 years. And he can really, his job is to occupy other people's personalities, right? Write as them. What he's done with this book is it's a social history of Beatlemania. And he has turned the conventional biography on its head. He's picked up a biography that you expect to start here and here, has an index, has footnotes. He's gone, no. He's picked it up like it's a vase and smashed it on the ground and then taken up each piece of the story and like stuck it together in a sort of cubist way. So it's multi-perspective. He takes fans as seriously as historians. He uses letters and nostalgia and memorabilia and stories. He plays with time and space. At the end of the book, he reverses what happened by starting in 1967, Brian Epstein, his overdose and death, and spools it back like a videotape all the way back from Brian Epstein's perspective to the day he walked down the steps of the cavern and discovered them. Clever. I don't feel emotional about this book. It's very clever. It didn't make me feel warmly about the Beatles, but it made me feel very warmly towards boomers, who everybody lost their minds in the 60s, and you've got to love that. So I highly recommend it.
Thank you very much. That is Leah McFall with her recommendations on books.